Our sponsor this week is Loot Crate, the OG nerd box. Okay, Loot Crate is kind of a legend, so you probably already know about them, but if you don't, here's the deal. Every month, they'll ship you a whole box of just amazing items centered around a particular theme, fandom, sports team. Hey, do they have Tom Brady Loot Crates?
Yeah, this week's been unbearable.
Seven.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, exactly. Will, exactly, Mr. William. Choose from a huge array of themes from Marvel to the Mets. Hey, the Mets.
Yeah, how many Super Bowls
to more
have?
General themes like gaming, anime, sci-fi, and so many more. Loot Crate works directly with creators and licensed providers to make new products that fans will be stoked to see.
Yeah, not to mention they offer local shipping to a ton of countries. I feel like our listeners are like all over the world. So listen up, international listener in the Federated States of Micronesia.
Island of Yap.
Don't despair if you are not in America. Loot Crate may be available to folks outside of North America. We'll include a link to Loot Crate in the description in this podcast. Click on it and use code STAYEXTRA, all one word, for 15% off your first order. That's STAYEXTRA, all one word, for 15% off your first order.
Hey, welcome to Extraneous.
Welcome to Extraneous.
This is the podcast that goes deep on stories you love and comes back with a little something extra.
That's right. We are right in the middle of Amber Spyglass.
Quarter of the way through, technically. Y'all, what do you want us to do next?
Yeah, what do you want us to do?
We have some ideas, and we've been tossing some things around.
We can do Tom Brady Super Bowls.
No, he can do that on his own.
Yeah, so let us know in our socials, on our messaging board, right on the blackboard outside our office.
Let us know. extraneouspod@gmail.com is, I think, what Will was searching for there. You could also hit us up on social, extraneouspod on Twitter, extraneous.pod on Instagram. Also, you are listening to a Mischief Media podcast. That means whatever you're listening to us on, go ahead and type Mischief Media into the search bar and you will find a great number of cool podcasts, cool cats and kittens podcasts that you might like to listen to, such as
Pottercast, which just put out an episode. And speaking of Pottercast, have you considered Roll 9 3/4?
You should. There's another episode of that coming shortly as well.
Yeah. So Roll 9 3/4 is a D&D podcast set in the world of Hogwarts, starring Melissa Anelli and the other people from Pottercast.
So there's four of us. Right. Frankie is the DM from Pottercast. He came to us one day and said, I've got this idea and I would like to play D&D with y'all in the world of Harry Potter. We were like, yes, thank you. Let's do that. And it's so much fun. We're still finding our way.
It's really good.
I'm now like a big D&D listener. I listen to Taz. I listen to Critical Role. I listen to like the Not Another D&D podcast. And it's not one of those, but it is a lot of fun in a world that we all know and love, and I think you'll enjoy it.
And while you're checking out Mischief Media, you should check out Mischief merch.
Yes, you should. We have a Jordan College sweatshirt, which is great for these winter months if you're in a winter side of the universe.
And just get the Jordan College sweatshirt and
I believe you can use the code STAYEXTRA on any Mischief Media piece of merch. All right, now we are on chapter 7 and 8 of Amber Spyglass, and we're getting into it. All right, it is Will's turn to summarize as fast as he can.
I'm just stretching out over here.
He's limbering up.
Just doing my windmills.
Ready?
Ready.
And go.
So Mary Malone is in Chitagatse and she leaves an old couple's house who give her some cheese. And then she goes into the Malefitinville world and she walks around and she has a nap under some trees and she almost gets brained by some giant seeds. And so she runs out away from the trees, and then she sees this dust cloud coming towards her, and it turns out it's the Mulefa, the Mulefy Dumps. And they like get on like gangbusters and exchange names, and she hops on the back of one of the Mulefa, and they go trundling off to Malefitinville. And then, meanwhile, Will is in like the opposite place, the worst possible place in the world. Will is like walking along. Oh, Balthamos realizes that Brooke has died. It's obviously a big moment for him. Then Will comes into this village, and it's a really bad place, and there's a priest that does some pretty suspect things and makes him do shots and talks to him a bunch of like inappropriate kind of humor, and it all seems like it's something out of the movie Spotlight. And then Will leaves and goes into town, and the bears, our favorite bears, are fighting the townspeople and winning, and they're in the ship in the middle of the river. Will says that he's going to fight Yorick in single combat, and then he convinces Yorick to hand him his helmet, and then he cuts his helmet up into strips using the amazing, amazing, incredible knife. And Yorick says, I can't fight that. And they all come to an agreement, and Will goes on to the boat with Yorick, and the chapter ends.
All right. Just under 2 minutes. 1:59.
Yeah, it got away from me.
It got a little bit away from you. I give that a solid 7.2.
7.2. All right, that's
generous. These chapters are deceptively heavy.
Yeah, deceptively full.
They also start with some epigraphs, so we're gonna talk about them.
That's right, or epigrammographs.
I know that they're epigraphs now. Hey.
Do you?
Am I wrong?
I have no idea.
It literally says epigraphs in our outline, which is why I was faking to know it myself.
I know. I wrote that.
Are you punking me?
I'm not punking you, but I might be punking me.
No, an epigraph is what's on a tombstone.
That's an epitaph.
No, that's an epitaph. Why can't I get this right? I swear to God, I have a college degree. Why can't I get this right?
So our first epigraph, we're just going to go with that, is from Milton. It's from Book 7 of Paradise Lost. It reads, last rose, as in dance, the stately trees and spread their branches hung with copious fruit, maintaining that 17th century spelling, which is awesome.
Which, it's for which word?
Spread is F-P-R-E-D.
F as in Frank?
17th century script, the S would be an F, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway.
Interesting.
So 17th century spellings on this epigraph, mm-hmm. And it is epigraph, I checked.
Last rose, as in dance, the stately trees and spread their branches hung with copious fruit.
This is a selection from Book 7 of Paradise Lost, describing the creation of Eden.
Yes.
Do we think that Philip Pullman needs to bang us on the head any harder about Malefitinville being Eden? Is that like a thing that he thinks people aren't going to catch before the end of Amber Spyglass with the whole falling tempter being cast out? Like, is this a thing that Philip Pullman just wants to make sure he gets really, really clear?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these epigraphs have been pretty, like, bang on the head.
Yeah.
Like...
yeah, and they don't have to be anything other than that. They're pretty, they're fun reminders, but mm-hmm. Just in case you weren't clear, Malefitin is Eden. Spark note aside, it's Eden.
Well, I think it's interesting because you can read this and not look up the passage that it's from.
Yes.
And just be like, oh, it's like trees. Some Milton thing. Yeah, it's like trees, like right. The trees in the chapter.
Trees and fruit, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But if you do look up the quote, it's like, oh, right. This is another little tilt towards this place will stand as Eden.
This is
us.
Eden, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the first one. In the second chapter is a quote from Exodus. It just says, I have been a stranger in a strange land. There's a very famous Robert Heinlein novel called Stranger in a Strange Land, science fiction novel. I did not realize until I looked up this quote that it was from the Bible. I guess I'm not surprised by it.
But I didn't know either.
Yeah, I knew it was something, mm-hmm. But it's from Exodus. If you look up the passage it's from, it's not really clear that the context of it has anything to do with what happens in the chapter. I think it's more like what we were talking about. This is like a just very literal, like, here's a quote from the Bible about being a stranger in a strange land. And that's what Will is in this chapter.
On to our characters. What's happening with Lyra in these chapters?
Well, not much.
Not much. Very, like, three words.
Yeah. But we just get a great little character beat. It's not anything new, but it's a reminder of who Lyra is, I think. Roger. So this is in the little interstitial before the chapter.
Mm-hmm. The which art end? Chapters. These are the last two chapters with them, I believe.
Oh, yeah. And so Roger is continuing a thought that he had from the last interstitial that's saying, like, I know you're going to save us because you're Lyra. And it said that then she realized what that meant. She felt dizzy. Even in her dream, she felt a great burden settle on her shoulders.
That's also paired with the second interstitial in these two chapters, which is Lyra saying, because he's Will.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Right. And when you pull those two out and look at them together, it's Lyra and Will. They're out. It's going to save the world.
Yeah. And again, it's banging on this idea of, like, you have to do the right thing if you know what it is. Right? Remember Amma being like, she didn't want to do the thing, but now that it had been said that she could go wake up Lyra, she's just going to have to do it because it's the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. Or Lyra and Pan talking about going and saving Dust, like researching Dust and saving Roger at the end of book one. Neither of them want to do it. Both of them are terrified. Both of them are like, recovering from this trauma, mm-hmm. but it's the thing to do. And so they need to do it. And I think this is where Lyra is really starting to feel she's not her normal excited self. Like it's starting to wear on her the fact that she once again has to like shoulder this unbelievable burden, mm-hmm. but she's going to have to do it because it's who she is.
Yeah. It's also, she's becoming self-aware of, you know, mm-hmm. this greatness around her. She's always not really partaken in it. And now when Roger says to her, well, you're Lyra, it hits her so hard that in a dream state, she gets dizzy. It's starting to become clear to her that she does have a big world-ending mission, even though it's just, a, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a big deal. She's losing her innocence,
she's
really.
She's kind of a big deal. All right.
So that's our little Lyra moment. Let's talk about Mary.
Big Mary chapter.
Oh, big Mary chapter. Mary alone.
Alone, but not alone.
Alone, but not alone.
Elude the Malufi dumps.
Okay. Because they're the Malufi dumps.
They're the Malefa, but Will is insistent on calling them the Malufi dumps. So the Spectres seem to know who she is instinctively. They're afraid of her.
Yeah, something about her. And we don't get a lot of clarity on this. Like, is she enveloped in grace by some unseen force? You know, the same force that we learn is granting Lyra her ability to read the alethiometer. It's a mess.
Well, let's call it grace.
Yeah.
Spectres have a graceometer. They see her in the red zone and they stay away. There's a word. There's it's named after a person.
Oh, Geiger counter?
It's a Geiger counter. Right. Geiger counter for grace or grace counter. High in the red zone, Spectres stay away. And she, like Lyra, is starting to realize who she is, that she has a purpose, that she has to move on. She's reading her I Ching. She's trying to sort of understand. And it leads her into Mulefa world. It's Eden. And there are these big trees that drop these big pods that become big wheels for these big animals.
Yes.
And that will be important.
The wheels on the trees go round and round. So Mary already has this sense of mission, and you can make an argument this isn't really new, that we've seen this in previous chapters, but something is pushing her along. You know, she wants to stay with all these people, especially because if she is with some of the people in Chitagatse, they are safe. It's like the only time that they are safe from the specters. And so everyone wants her to stay. And obviously she, you know, just being who she is, she would like to. And obviously, Chitagatse, it's a beautiful place. Every description of it is just absolutely beautiful. Something is pushing her forward, and she doesn't really know what it is, and we, the readers, don't know what it is. But she actually says here, the book says here, then she thought, I came here for a purpose, although I don't understand it yet. Be bold, take the initiative. This is when she's hiding from the Malefa, and she gets out and says hello to them. But like, these decisions, I don't know. I guess it's ambiguous that there's something pushing her forward, but also the reason that she was chosen is because she is the type of person who will take the initiative. I think the lines are blurred here between how much this is nature versus fate, like Mary's nature versus the fate of
Muffly dumps. She meets these strange creatures. She mm-hmm. decides to start talking to them. She starts to work out a communication structure with them. And by the end of, you know, a minute talking to them, she's being invited into their ranks. Clearly, she knows she's on the right path.
She has the tools to be able to do this, right? Mm-hmm. She is observant, first mm-hmm. of all. She's a scientist. And so she could see, like, they're different than, like, the antelope things she sees. They're intelligent.
She gets to this world, and already what has presented to her is the key dichotomy that dust or sraf will make for her, but she doesn't know it yet. But she sees the difference of a being with consciousness versus a being without consciousness. She's already starting to put those pieces together. When I remember first reading these books thinking, like, just from a plot perspective, you send this person on this mission that has to do with Lyra, that has to do with Will, that has to do with your main characters, and suddenly she's in a world with antelope beasts that talk and trees that spit wheels onto the ground, and first time I read it, I was like, what is happening here? It feels like such a diversion. And then everything he does from here on in proves why this is such a key puzzle piece to what is happening in this world.
Yeah, definitely. And it's such a challenge to come up with something that is actually fundamentally different in some way from our worlds. You know, Chitagatse and Will's world and Lyra's world are all basically the same world. They have the same physics, they have the same animals, they have the same plants for the most part. You know, the demon is itself an incredible act of creativity. Yeah.
All right, Balthamos. We'll go back to Mary and the Muffly Dumps in Mufflersonville a little later. Balthamos. Balthamos realizes, we go back to the moment where Balthamos feels the death of Baruch, but what he does with Baruch's death is kind of beautiful.
He mourns him, and then he eventually comes back down to Will, and he makes this like whole speech about, I'm going to try to be better than the person that I've been, because it's, you know, it's like what Baruch always represented for me, was like the best of life and the best of me, and that's what he always saw in me. It's really,
we are spirit from what we do matter, right? So what Baruch did is changing who Balthamos is. And the idea of the impact of another person's consciousness, being, presence in this world can actually have a clear impact on the fate of the universe is right here in what Balthamos says.
I've decided what I must do. I shall stay with you day and night and do it cheerfully and willingly for the sake of Baruch. I shall guide you to Lyra if I can, and then I shall guide you both to Lord Ezreal. I have lived thousands of years, and unless I am killed, I shall live many thousands of years more. But I never met a nature that made me so ardent to do good, or to be kind, as Baruch's did. I failed so many times, but each time his goodness was there to redeem me. Now it's not. I shall have to try without it. Perhaps I shall fail from time to time, but I shall try all the same.
You see, he decided to honor Baruch by refusing to give up the mission, by refusing to give into despair, to be as good as Baruch would have wanted.
Yeah.
So it changed him.
Yeah.
Okay, Will.
Will Perry.
What a chapter for our Will. Will meets Yorick, knows he's Yorick, knows he has to win him over, and through an act of cunning and incredible bravery, we're talking about Gryffindor and Slytherin coming together in the biggest way.
Yeah.
Take a shot, Melissa mentioned Harry Potter. But tells Yorick he'll fight him one-on-one.
Yeah.
Yorick assents. He said, but he says, you're too...
First of all, he's like, no way.
He's like, no, you're like a bug. He goes, fine, give me a piece of your armor.
Yeah.
And when he gives him, which Will must have gamed out, because when he says, fine, I'll show you what my armor can do and what my knife can do, and he shreds his knife, his helmet to ribbons.
His helmet, he can't even pick up the helmet.
But he takes out the knife and he just shreds it. And Yorick, in his classic way, just kind of stares him down and says, ah, yeah, okay, you win. You win, it's fine.
Too powerful a weapon.
But he does this to get the bears out of a situation in which they're in a confrontation with the townspeople who don't understand them. So he like rushes in to kind of save the bears, but has to come up with this cunning, incredibly brave plan to get them out of this predicament while also proving himself to the king of the bears.
Yeah.
And in that moment, Yorick says like, I'm Yorick Bernison. And Will just says, I know you are.
I know you are.
He took one look at him. He says, that's Yorick, who Lyra's always talking about. Uh-huh. I gotta get in there. And in a moment, he makes this plan where he overpowers the bear through sheer cunning, force of strength, incredible bravery. It's such a cool scene.
It's such a cool scene. And it's Will at his best, because Will is a warrior. Will is a fighter, especially in the books. You know, everyone talks about it, but Will doesn't want to fight. He's a leader. He's a strategist. You know, he's a good general in a sense. And he gamed all this out. And this is the way where, like, maybe if he had had to fight Yorick, he could have killed Yorick. Who would have known? Who knows? I think probably, I don't know. But clearly he had no intention of actually fighting Yorick. And he every time that Will can avoid fighting to get what he needs, he will choose it. But that doesn't mean taking the less brave path. Do you know what I mean? He's like courageous, yes, but not.
For a reason, like when he needs to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Belligerent. He's not reckless.
Yeah.
It seems reckless to rush in the path of a bear and say, I'll fight you one-on-one. But it's not. He knows exactly what he's doing. And it also sets him up as such a formidable enemy. He's this kid. He's a squishy bug to Yorick. But now Yorick knows him, knows who he is, knows who he is inside, and knows how formidable he is. And is already thinks highly of him, which, if you're taking like Yorick as a father figure to Lyra, it's sort of like he's going to give Will his blessing, because he's like, oh, okay. You're maybe not equal to her, but you're in her range, we'll say.
Right. And I think there's an element of Will learning from Lyra here. And it's Will's ability here to do the thing, to come up with a great plan, and then to not think about all the ways that it could go wrong, like all the ways that it won't work, and he could get hit by a bullet, he could get hit by the bear's fire thrower, someone could not go for it. I remember Philip Pullman describing Lyra as having no imagination, and we went back and forth on that, because it seems to be the opposite of Lyra. Mm-hmm. Like, Lyra has the most imagination.
Right.
But she has that, like, professional athlete thing of she's going to come up with the idea, and then she's just going to put her blinders on and do it. And she's not going to get in her head about the million ways that, like, Yofur is going to realize that she's lying or that something else is going to go wrong.
No, she makes a plan. She commits to it.
Yeah.
That's it.
And Will seems here to be doing a similar thing.
Right.
And it's cool to see them learning from each other.
Right. All right, let's talk about the other character that Will interacts with.
Yeah.
Atyets Semyon?
Semyon? I think, so Atyets, I guess, means father, like priest. Mm-hmm. So you call him like Father Semyon. And I think Semyon is meant to sound like Simeon, like an ape.
Okay.
Because this is this exact last name is used in the same metaphorical way in season 2 of True Detective with Vince Vaughn's character.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I've seen it other places too. This is a kind of a trope using the Semyon as like Simeon. But yeah, what do you make of this guy?
He's a clear predator.
Yeah.
He is.
Yes.
But I've been struggling. So here's what happens. Will comes into the village and they talk to him, and he insists, like strongly insists, that Will drink with him. He sort of touches him on his knee inappropriately. Mm-hmm. It's very uncomfortable. And he doesn't want Will to leave. They talk about a variety of things. He's this massive old man. He's bearded. He has a crow for a demon. He hates witches and bears. They're children of the devil, he says. Yes. They need to all be put to death. He's very magisterium, very religious, fanatic, very there is one way and everything else. You know, he's a fundamentalist, basically, for his religion. I've been struggling a lot with why is this here? You know?
Yeah.
What is the function of this paragraph? And I don't know if Will needs a point of reference for how ruthless and evil the Magisterium can be. He needs a point of reference for what they're fighting against. He needs a point of reference for the rot that they are trying to under. Because after this, he's going to find Lyra. They're going to go to the world of the dead. He may never have really had an interaction with the thing besides Mrs. Coulter that Lyra claims is what she's fighting so hard against. So maybe it was a moment of like pure distaste, pure bad for Will to get into his soul about that which he's supposed to be set against.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of the scene in Game of Thrones, and spoilers for, I don't know, season 4 of Game of Thrones here, but where Arya and the Hound are doing their little like buddy comedy traveling thing, and they go into the tavern, and it's like the "I'm gonna eat all your chicken," this big sword fight scene. It's an awesome scene. But aside from like the big sword fight of that scene, you see like the Lannister soldiers, they're like raping all the innkeeper's daughters. They're eating all the food and drinking all the ale for free. They're basically ruining this tavern keeper. And it's like, oh yeah, this is the stakes. This is what happens when the Lannisters are in charge. It's not just a political struggle at the top and like, who cares except for this like three dozen aristocrats. It's like, no, it matters who's in charge, because like it matters to the people in the land and how they're treated. And when Lyra and the Hound leave that scene, it's like it's a victorious scene because, you know,
Arya and the Hound.
Who did I say?
Lyra.
Oh man, Lyra and the Hound, please. Somebody write that fanfic. When Arya and the Hound leave, it's like a triumphant scene because he's got his chicken and she's got her sword back. But you see the land all around is like smoking. It's like the Lannisters have just burned everything. And I think this is a similar thing. It's showing like this is not just a theoretical discussion. This really matters. And so I think that's part of it. Yeah, it's like at the ground level. And it's the poorest people who suffer the most. These like helpless villages who are really,
right,
they have no recourse and they'll never have any recourse.
Right.
You know?
Right.
For centuries it'll be like this. I think it's a nod to why I mentioned the like something out of the Spotlight, the movie Spotlight. Mm-hmm. I think it's a nod to the sex scandals in the church. I think it's pretty explicit.
Honestly, if you're Philip Pullman and you're creating this story and the church is so evil and their church is so predatory, but you haven't shown that they're predatory towards young people sexually, maybe for him it's like, wait, I can't not show that this is a key part of how people that you force into chastity can abuse their power to play on the weak and the young.
Yeah, absolutely. He probably thinks like, of course, this would be so much worse in this world even than it was in the real world in the Catholic Church, because it's like the whole world and there's no recourse. It's sort of like a Porter scene in a sense, but it's like rather than comic relief, it's like a sinister Porter scene.
And you say Porter scene, meaning that Shakespeare had this trope where he would go to the porters for, and maybe not just Shakespeare
specifically,
but yes, yeah, the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, right? Mm-hmm. But that's Hamlet. Macbeth is the porter scene where they're joking and it's all is right before the real disaster hits. It's before the raid on the castle, and so it's, you know, everything's light and funny. Ha ha ha! Oh God, now we're in it.
Right. It's like a gallows scene. It's a bit like the Harbinger scene or in horror movies. Most famous in Cabin in the Woods, but you know, it's the scene where like the teens pull into the gas station and the like weird gas station owner is like, nobody's been up to that house since the murder 30 years ago. And the teens ignore him and go to the house anyway and all get murdered. I think you can interpret it a lot of ways. It's one of my least favorite scenes to read because it is so viscerally unsettling, but it's one of my favorite scenes to think about. Because it's just this, it like radiates darkness. It's like a Black Lodge-y to
Absolutely. It's got a Lynchian feel, you're right. It feels out of place, it feels wrong, it feels uncomfortable. It sits weirdly, and before Willow sort of lurched into his next.
Yeah, I mean, the houses there, because they just had an earthquake, are literally tilted.
The
entire village is physically leaning and tilted. Very geometry of this place is off.
Yorick's being Yorick.
Yeah, he's like, guys, I don't want to kill you, but I'm willing
to kill you.
And I'm
really
good
at
killing you.
You'll taste good when I'm done. Also, we're starving. Have you noticed that we're a bunch of giant bears who are starving? Maybe you should not
mess with us. Don't attack three ships full of armored bears with heavy artillery on board.
I think that's it. I think it's time for Dust Bears.
Yeah,
Dust Bears. Big ideas of the chapters in here.
So I wrote I Ching, and then I said, I'm going to research I Ching.
As
and
I was reading the chapter, I was like, I'm going to research I Ching. I'm going to try I Ching. I'm going to like go to I Ching websites. Guess how much of that I did?
Right.
Zero. So we want to talk about the I Ching in more detail, but we're going to hold it for a minute. It's not the end of Mary's interaction with it, and we want to do it right. So we're going to
hold on that. Maybe we'll get a guest.
That'd be great. If you know anybody who's really good at the I Ching and is scholarly about it, yeah. If not, gonna get my research fingers ready.
Because we know nothing.
Nothing. So, Pin and I Ching, we'll be back with that. Mulefertonville. Okay, we need to name that world. It's Earth Mulefa, but I don't know what to call it. Mulefertin, like Bridgerton?
I like Mulefertonville, Hamptonshire.
Okay, Mulefertin. We're calling it Mulefertin.
Here and there on the plain were stands of the tallest trees Mary had ever seen. Attending a high-energy physics conference once in California, she had taken time out to look at the great redwood trees and marveled. But whatever these trees were, they would have overtopped the redwoods by half again at least. Their foliage was dense and dark green, their vast trunks gold-red in the heavy evening light.
So something that struck me on reading this was that these trees in Mulefertonville are way bigger than redwoods, which are the biggest trees I've ever seen in my life. And not just like a little, but by a lot. So
I'm so jealous. I've never seen them.
When you imagine this big seed pod falling down and cracking the ground,
yeah,
falling from that height, and it doesn't just completely crack open,
yeah,
that they still have to roll around on the wheels to get them to really, man.
Yeah. Immensely hard, she describes them as. Like, she takes out her knife and she tries to even make a scratch on them, and she can't. And he's like you can make a scratch on granite with a knife, but you can't on diamond.
You cannot on diamond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
These are like diamond hard.
Diamond hard.
Cool. Don't get bopped on the head by one of these.
Well, she almost died because yeah. She just got into the shade of the tree and boom, boom, there comes a seed pod. So Mulefertin is beautiful. Everything seems to be in balance to everything else, which is important.
Yeah, it's teeming with life, right?
Yes.
Like an insect life. Yes. The line about like...
There were so many bugs.
Yeah, so many bugs. I know, it's a little gross, but it's a sign of a healthy ecosystem.
Healthy ecosystem. Yeah. Untouched by industry, untouched by a church.
Mm-hmm.
It's just things that need each other to survive and all contribute to the circle of life.
Yeah. A little bit on the seed pods themselves. They're as thick as a human hand, perfectly round, immensely hard, covered in tiny furs, and exuding a sort of oil that apparently smells pretty good.
Thick as a human hand would be from the front flat part to the back flat part. So,
yeah.
So they're like basically like cylindrical. So they're big and round, and then four or five inches. Like imagine a flat circle on a piece of paper that you pick the top up, and now you've got like a coffee can. They're not circular. They're not spherical. They're cylindrical in my mind.
Yeah, I think they're shaped like wheels. They're like...
Right, they're wheels. Yeah. They're wheels, which are cylinders more than...
yes, exactly. Yes, yes, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Kind of disc shaped.
How big you think?
It purposely doesn't mention... Yeah, I think maybe two and a half feet.
Yeah, a tricycle or a bicycle
wheel.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what I picture them. Maybe a little big, maybe like a bike wheel size. Yeah.
3 feet.
That's how I picture them.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe 3 feet in diameter. And like 5 inches thick.
That's, you know, for them to fall from that high of a height and not crack would indicate they are very fibrous, very hard.
Mm. The hairs remind me of like shark skin almost.
Reminds me of coconuts.
Oh, yes. No, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
You like rub your hand one way over coconuts and they're smooth. You rub the other way, it's bristle. Or your beard sometimes.
Or my beard, yeah.
So they're like cylindrical coconuts.
But not hollow and way harder.
Philip Pullman invents coconut water.
I want to know what it smells like.
Like
melon.
Argan oil. It's kind of the image I have in my head.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like that slick, thick, serum-y kind of oil. And it has that earthy smell.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
I don't think a flowery scent.
No, I think so too. I think like a sandalwood or a myrrh kind of situation.
Yeah. Totally. So Mary, looking at all these, dives into her scientific brain about evolution and now about quantum theory. She's starting to put all the pieces together and she's already starting to marry science and faith in a way that's going to continue going through the end.
If her guess about these universes was right, and they were the multiple worlds predicted by quantum theory, then some of them would have split off from her own much earlier than others. And clearly in this world, evolution had favored enormous trees and large creatures with a diamond-framed skeleton.
So I just think this is so cool that Philip Pullman actually came up with something different. it's hard
in what way?
To do. It's just like, it's hard to come up with a world that is actually different from our world. It's like, how do you imagine a different evolution, right?
The full way every piece of this world that he's imagined intersects like a big puzzle is pretty great.
It's great. And I really wonder if he set himself the challenge of like, if I'm really going to come up with something different, I have to come up with something that's physically impossible in nature and then somehow make it possible. Like wheels. Mm-hmm. Wheels can't, he's right.
They can't exist in nature. They're two separate pieces. They must, yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work. So he found a way to make it work.
And they aren't, like they technically aren't in nature. The cylindrical shape exists in nature, but the use as wheels do not. He just made it look so natural.
Right. I mean, you could say like, oh, you know, dung beetles roll little balls and like lots of things do. But yeah, it is, it's just wild to me. A diamond frame skeleton, what?
Yeah.
The fact that he came up with demons and the muffly bumps in the same book series, it's like, this is good science fictioning, man.
It is good. It is good fantasy and science fictioning. Absolutely. Yeah. It builds on. Do you think these books are a marriage between science fiction and fantasy?
I do. I guess they're usually considered fantasy, mm-hmm. and I can certainly see that. Mm-hmm. But I think they're more science fiction than fantasy.
So I think if you replace fantasy with religion, and a lot of people would argue that religion is fantasy, mm-hmm. then this book is purposefully a marriage between the two. Mm. Science and faith, science and things not seen, science and things that don't exist in nature.
Yeah, I think that's true. Because he really goes out of his way to ground what in Game of Thrones would be fantasy elements in scientific theory. Yeah. Like he wants theoretical consistency. Mm-hmm. It makes me glad for a term like speculative fiction.
Yeah.
Because that's really what this is.
Yes.
It's more concerned with telling its story than with, you know, meeting a certain style.
Let's talk about the Mulefa.
The Muffly Bumps.
Muffly Bumps, Mulefa.
What she saw made her head spin. At first it looked like a motorcycle gang. Then she thought it was a herd of wheeled animals. But that was impossible. No animal could have wheels. She wasn't seeing it. But she was. There were a dozen or so. They were roughly the same size as the grazing creatures, but leaner and grey-coloured, with horned heads and short trunks like elephants. They had the same diamond-shaped structure as the grazers, but somehow they had evolved, on their front and rear single legs, a wheel.
Rolling antelopes.
I love it. They're an elephant motorcycle gang.
I want like the Starlight Express version of Amber Spyglass. I want them to have roller rinks. I want them to compete. Like, how do they not have sports?
How do they not have sports?
Right?
Yeah.
At some point, they're going to invent sports.
Hell's Dumbos.
It'd be really curious if they created recreation. I guess they do have some recreation. Mm-hmm. We hear about it a little bit later.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to see a competitive muffly bump sport.
And they seem like very adoptive, like the humans that they start interacting with. This could be a whole headcanon. This could be a whole fiction series. Mm-hmm, like, they're going to bring the concept of sports to the Mulefa. Of course, they're going to love it. Of course, they're going to adopt it into some wonderful version of their own.
Right.
And it's going to be awesome.
I have a fan art challenge for a Mulefa sports team.
Yes.
First person to get that will get some sort of merch mm-hmm. from the store.
Yeah, we will tweet about that later. We'll make that official. Mm-hmm.
Another thing is that there's two types of muffly bumps. Mm. There's the conscious muffly bumps, and then there's the cows, basically. So he's setting up the dichotomy. The dumdy bumps.
Dumdy bumps.
Muffly bumps and the dumdy bumps. And the dumdy bumps are just grazing. And he's setting up the very nature of consciousness, and that the very presence of dust or srof turns them conscious. And as we've noted, it seems to be inherently good. Like mm-hmm. there's no evil influences on these people, on these bumps yet. And they are inherently good. So is Philip Pullman making a statement about consciousness for itself, not being neutral, being generally good?
Generally good. Well, it seems like the antelopes, the dum-dum bumps are good and the muffly bumps are good.
The dum-dum bumps, I would say, are neutral.
They're neutral, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like they're not hostile.
They're not the white birds.
No. Yeah. The white birds are a separate thing. We'll talk lots about them coming soon because they're important. Yeah, I think consciousness is generally a good thing in Philip Pullman's world.
I mean, they are literally animals to whom dust was applied. It's like the trepanning, right? It's like what they were trying to do by opening up a hole in their head and allowing communication. This is a world in which that happened at some point, and then evolution buffeted it and fanned it into existence, where the dust got into one of these creatures and a consciousness developed.
Yeah. And I mean, especially if you see the Magisterium as aligning themselves against dust and therefore against consciousness, and the Magisterium obviously being the bad guys. Yeah, I think that the free flow of dust is positive and essential to all that is good in the world, whether that's big stuff like art and music and sex, or just like having a nice having like a nice little communal existence where everyone kind of cares about everyone else. That it's all part of the dust umbrella.
All right. Well, that's our dusty bumps.
Dusty bumps.
That's our dusty bumps for this episode. Let's get into our dust bunnies.
Dust bunnies. So this is, you take this first one because you're the one who actually.
Yeah. So there is a description of a window, one of the holes in the universes that Mary comes across. So she's like bumping through a bunch of them.
Yeah. It's the one between Chittagatse and Muffleton.
And it says the narrator just completely shifts and imparts upon us the wisdom that this window was cut in the 1770s. What? Is it Philip Pullman just like really want to tell us that? By Benjamin Franklin. It was very bizarre. It's a very like, this is not the tone this narrator normally takes. And it was just seemed to be very important that we know that this was that old of a window.
You know, Philip Pullman once in a while falls in love with the line and just throws it in, you know, like that line about like all the possibilities having balanced, and then Will, like right now all things are possible, but then Will would have to make a choice and, you know, he'd commit to one thing.
Right.
It was another line that like,
did this actually have to be here, or are we giving you license? And I'm down for it. Give me the extra information as long as it doesn't go too far. But it was a jarring moment.
Yeah. I do like these little bits of color. I really liked the moment when Mary wakes up in Muleffeton and says she awoke with the early sun full in her face. The air was cool and the dew had settled in tiny beads on her hair and on the sleeping bag. She lay for a few minutes lapped in freshness, feeling as if she were the first human being who had ever lived. I think this is a really intentionally resonant paragraph, that the dew reminds us of dust. The reference to Eve, to the first person who had ever lived, seems deliberate. Obviously, she's not Eve, but she is like very contingent to Eve. Mm-hmm. I really like the way that this paragraph is not explicitly about these things, but is absolutely resonant with these big themes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very similar with the line about the floor of the grove feeling much as if she were in a cathedral. It's the same idea. This like
it's also dust, right? Dust are angels, are structures, they're cathedrals. That's what the angels describe themselves. And so it seems as though she's looking at the interconnectedness of all this world as basically dust and consciousness itself.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
I agree.
It's just she's putting all the pieces together in a cool way.
Yeah, this idea of the same awe within herself. This maybe is like Philip Pullman's idea of good religious awe. It's not like, oh, worship me, bow down before me. It's like a sense of the beauty and the power of the world and of the same beauty and power within oneself. Mm-hmm. It's just a nice conception of what worship and God might look like under a republic of heaven or whatever.
Yeah. There's also this great little line, if you can laugh, I don't suppose you'll eat me, that Mary thinks about the monthly bumps. Creatures that have a sense of humor don't tend to be foreboding, or like a joyful sense of humor don't tend to be predatory.
Right.
Does
this go to your idea about like consciousness is basically good?
It's basically like, good. Without other things to impress upon it, it basically exists in a good balance. I could be wrong. This is like a working theory.
Yeah.
But think about how many easily laughing people turn out to be evil. Very few.
Yeah. Yeah. There's very little joy from the bad guys.
Yeah.
Mrs. Coulter, I do not think, has really laughed at all. No. All series.
No.
So a new entry in the angelology department here. The bit about Metatron being able to see everything about Will that angels were able to see, including parts of which Will himself was not aware, such as that aspect of his nature Lyra would have called his demon. It's like angels can see a broader spectrum of light.
Yeah, Serafina, we know, can do this too. Later, she can see Mary's demon.
There are animals that can see a much broader spectrum of light than humans can.
Oh, okay.
So like the world looks very different to them. Uh-huh, it's just, it's one of those trippy cool facts. It's like, what do they see? Yeah, I think that's it for...
That's it for our dust bunnies.
Yeah.
Let's get into our lithiometer.
So my first symbol is the walled garden, and it's for this little village of Kolodnoia, if I'm saying
Kolodnoia.
That right. Kolodnoia.
We just watched a lot of The Americans.
Yeah, which very little Russian on The Americans for all those
Too
Russians.
Much, frankly. Had to do a lot of reading, and I like my television to be when I don't have to look at it.
Oh, yeah, no, that's right. Actually, there's a lot of Russian spoken, although our stars speak very little Russian.
It was good. I don't really always, but sometimes I just want the television to be on.
I feel the same way. Like, I'm trying to be on my phone. I'm not trying to read
to be on my phone.
subtitles here.
What do you think? I'm trying to watch this? Get out of here.
I know this is in shot in Russian, but come on. Yeah, the walled garden, there are different meanings for this. Usually they're pretty good. In this sense, I mean it in a bad way. This is like, it's like a bad place. It's like a walled off, almost medieval village full of superstition and bad vibes. And you get this hint of like terrible things have happened here. And there's a lot of poverty, a lot of exploitation. It's a sinister place. This walled garden would have like dead roses and rotting wrought iron gates and all that gothic stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So that's my first one. Second one is cauldron, and this is for Will. Will is really being tested here with showing leadership to get Balthamos in line and motivating Balthamos to like actually really help him achieve what he needs him to do, even though Balthamos has suffered this unbelievable loss that he'll like really never get over. Will still needs to find Lyra, still needs to do the things that he needs to do. He's tested with Father Simeon, and then he's tested once again in the village with the bears. Every time he passes, you really see him growing into this incredible like leader, not just a fighter, but an actual leader, you know. And then the third one is the dolphin, and this is for the Malefa. Dolphin, one of these that very rarely gets used. Mm-hmm, is this the first time we've used
it? I think it is. Maybe.
One of the meanings of dolphin is mercy. And this is for the Malefa, who really, they find Mary and they really like help her out. I mean, she is in this strange world and anything could have happened with this interaction. But instead they come out, they see her, they come find her. They take her bag, they give her a ride, they introduce themselves, and they're going to take her to their little village. This is really
nice.
Kind.
Yeah.
It's kindness.
And they look weird like dolphins.
They have a whole nose situation like dolphins. So those are mine.
Well, my first one is also the walled garden, but because of Malefertin. Malefertinville. Hamptonstead Shire. Malefertin is... I mean, I think that's what we've talked about it many times. It is Eden. It is a untouched, unspoiled place. So pretty much the opposite. Maybe he was trying to set up sort of a dichotomy in these chapters. I'm going to give Mary the Griffin.
Really?
For her courage.
Cool.
She's in a strange world. She hops out. She says, well, be bold.
Yeah.
Gotta go talk to these strange creatures who might eat me. Okay.
Yeah.
And she starts talking to them and she gives over to her weird mission she's on.
Right. Just
fine.
Love that journey for her.
And also the compass for the science and what she's starting to take in. She's the missing science piece of this world to try and understand it and take in the world around her.
So that's that. On to the extra award.
Who's your extra?
My extra award is the townspeople.
All of them?
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah, like, I agree.
What are you doing? Like,
How did you think this would go?
Yeah, exactly. Like, first of all, your ideas are totally outdated. You just fear the bears because you don't know them. But also, you're not going to beat them. This is what bears do. Bears make war. They're really good at it. They're covered in armor. They're like 10 feet tall. You're not going to beat the bears. just relax.
Yeah.
Just let them chill dock out.
Yeah, totally.
Move on. They don't want to be there either.
I think I have to give it to the weird, gross priest.
Yeah, fair.
It's not a positive extra award, but seriously, what are you doing? Like, no, gross, extra in a bad way.
Extra in a bad way. Yeah.
That's it. Atyets, dude.
Atyets.
Slow your roll. Take it down a hot second. Don't feed kids alcohol. Maybe you won't get the extra award. You know what time it is.
It's
my favorite time.
Oh, man. Mixtape time. Okay. The first song is a very depressing song. It's a very long song. It's a very bleak song.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to love listening to this in the playlist. By the way, Spotify playlist is up for Amber Spyglass. Finally, go check it out. We'll include a link in the description. It's a song by Songs Ohia, which is one of Jason Molina's...
they've appeared on our playlist before.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. From the same album. This is a companion song. This is one of Jason Molina's like projects. The song's called Blue Factory Flame. It's for the village of Kolodnoya.
Ooh, okay.
When I die, put my bones in an empty street. To remind me how it used to be.
Yeah, it's a really bleak song that I think is kind of set in one of these on the skids, Rust Belt American towns that's like racked by poverty and broken dreams and all this. It's a very bleak song. It really seems to capture not just the sinisterness, but like the emptiness, the way like malice and hopelessness really seem to mix in this little Russian village. You know, nothing's going to happen, but when something does happen, it's going to be something bad.
Cool.
So that's an anti-banger.
Okay, anti-banger.
Yeah. But don't worry, my second song is a little better. It's James Taylor's Carolina in My Mind. Mm.
In my mind, I'm gone to Carolina. Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? Guess I'm gone to Carolina in my mind.
It's for Malefitinville.
Malefitinville.
Because it's beautiful.
That's it. Okay.
I think it's one of the most beautiful songs ever written. It just describes a place that's beautiful and it just makes you feel good. And that really is what Malefitin is.
I have a song, not for this week, but one that I just thought of that I will use when the time is right.
All
from
right.
Malefitinville. It's not a banger. It's just a song. You know what, y'all?
Is it time?
That's it. That's it this week.
Gang, thank you so much for taking this journey with us. We are right in the middle of Amber Spyglass.
Chapters 9 and 10 coming at you next time.
9 and 10. Read up, join us, and
stay extra.
Stay extra.